WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
He's played with big bands, he's played in Hollywood and television bands, he's worked as a studio musician, he's led many dates, he's toured the world. He's self-taught. In the 1940s, he played with Charlie Barnett's and Artie Shaw's bands, and then in the 50s, he did a lot of recording and touring with Verve Records and with Jazz at the Philharmonic. A little later, we'll hear him in sessions recorded with Billie Holiday and Fred Astaire. He's recorded under his own name on the Concord Jazz label and on Contemporary Records. He's currently doing a lot of touring. He's holding seminars. He'll be teaching at various universities in the near future. He's also written columns in music magazines. Barnicastle has lived on the West Coast since the 1940s. He's east right now and will be playing tonight and tomorrow night at one of the Delaware Valley's newer jazz clubs. It's called the Flight Deck, and it's located at the airport in Wilmington on the DuPont Highway. And I'd like to just give you a phone number to call if you'd like more information about his appearance at this club. It's area code 302-328-0444. That's 302-328-0444. If you didn't catch it, I'll give it again later. Barnicastle, what a great pleasure to have you here.
Thank you very much, Terry. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Before we kind of get to the present, let's go backwards a little bit. I'm interested in how you started playing guitar and how you started playing jazz. You grew up in what, Muskogee?
Muskogee, Oklahoma. I did not really come from a musical family. I mean, they sort of, my mother might have sung while she's washing the dishes. My father might have been singing a little as he was doing various things around the house, but not really a musical family, not one that stressed musical values. But I used to work in a theater when I was a kid, about 10 years old, and I did many things. I sold popcorn. I was the usher. I sold tickets. I would do a number of things in this theater, but always while the motion pictures were going on. And so I saw movie after movie over and over again. I saw all the musicals in the 30s when I was so young that I had to sit on the armrest of a seat. And these musicals stayed with me, all the songs. And not only did I remember the music, but the words and also the dramatic situation in the picture that led up to the song. Like you say, you take a song like I Only Have Eyes for You. I remember what picture it was in, who did it, how they filmed the scene, and what led into the picture. So that kind of a song would have, or any of the songs that I grew up with, would have greater significance for me than just simply hearing a song done on a record.
Now, a lot of those tunes from the movies have become jazz standards,
yes,
but they certainly weren't done as jazz in the movies.
That's
for the most part.
And many, many things, you know, like you take a tune like Lady Be Good was originally done as a very soft, sweet ballad. Tunes have changed. Some songs were written in 3/4, and now they're done in 4/4. Always, they were done in one key to begin with. They're done now. Some of them were done very fast, and now the concept of them is very slow, or vice versa. But the main thing was that I was around music in the motion pictures a lot, and also I got to hear the music that was in the dramatic scoring. I mean, all these early Betty Davis pictures and Joan Crawford and Warner Brothers particularly comes to mind because they had Max Steiner writing music in his very, very heavy dramatic scenes. And being an usher and being a ticket taker and hearing this music and seeing a picture over and over again in the course of a week, I got to where I knew all the lines.
Now, I've often thought that the music that you are exposed to, the first music that you're exposed to when you're young, like from when you're growing up to maybe when you're 10 or 12, might really leave indelible marks on your mind. It might really be like the equivalent of the basic of your basic vocabulary, and that when you think musically, that the first things that you've heard are bound to affect the ways that you think musically and what you're capable of thinking musically. Do you think that?
To a certain extent, yeah, I'd say to a certain extent. For the most part, for instance, when I was a kid and we would listen to the radio, the music that was coming out of the radio was coming from places away from where I lived, and therefore the kind of music and the expertness with which it was played was far different than the kind of music I was growing up with. I came from Oklahoma. Everything there was strictly cowboy music, not even what you'd call hillbilly or western swing, but what you'd call cowboy music. The music of Gene Autry, Kamakaya, Yippee Yippee, that kind of thing. That's what I grew up with, hearing around where I was living. On the other hand, the music that's coming out of the radio were things coming from Hollywood and New York and larger orchestras and playing the pop music of the day.
Do you think that those kinds of musics that you grew up with affected your approach to jazz in any way?
Yes, somewhat. They certainly did affect and do affect right now what I consider to be a good song. For example, when I sit on a bandstand and want to play, I really want to play good music just like someone that's 20 years old or someone that's 80 years old. But my idea of what is good music might be different from theirs.
What are some of the tunes, for instance, that you really love to play now?
Well, for one thing, instead of just naming the tune, I would say that most of what I have heard written by people like Cole Porter, Irving Berlin, Vincent Humans, Rodgers and Hart, but it really doesn't have to be just those. It's just that they did what I wanted to do. They wrote the kind of music. It told the kind of story. It had the right kind of melody to turn me on. It's got the right kind of harmonic construction. On the other hand, there are tunes that come out through the years that every once in a while there's a good song. I mean, you know, Barbara Streisand wrote a beautiful song called Evergreen. I love many things that I've heard Barry Manilow do. I think they're just absolutely knockout songs. I like some songs that I've heard by the Carpenters. There's one called For All We Know of a few years ago. And there is no prejudice in wanting to cling to the songs of the 50s, but today, when I hear a good song, it is an exception. And in those days, it wasn't. And I think one of the reasons, if I could just say why this is that to a great extent, I do believe, I can't measure statistically, but I do believe that so much of what is put out today as musical production is first guided by money as to what will sell. And it's not that there's this particular musical message burning in the heart of the composer. Everything is written to order. What will we sell? What can we record? We need a hit. What do we do to make a hit?
You know, it's interesting that you take someone like Cole Porter or Rodgers and Hart. A lot of times they wrote songs because they were under great pressure to have like 24 songs for the show that was going to open in three weeks. Although a lot of what they've written are just really incomparable and classics and will endure for a long, 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 long time. But there was that pressure to produce there.
And it was also, Terry, situations where having written some of these songs, they later found out that there was no time to do the song. And so it was shelved, not because it was a bad song, but there wasn't time. Or they decided to cut out a certain scene, therefore they didn't need the song for that scene. And there are any number of songs that have been written this way where they just didn't use them, but not because of the merits of the song. There have also been great songs that have been sidetracked due to circumstances. For example, the first record on Nature Boy was made by Nat King Cole on Capitol Records. There was a beautiful song that was recorded on the other side called Lost April. And Lost April is an absolutely exquisite song, but no one would have ever heard it. And the composer of Lost April made as much money on the record sales as the other, because they both split the money on each side of the record. But people do not know Lost April. And it simply got lost because the other side of the record was played.
Do you like to play a lot of the bop standards?
Quite a few, especially the ones written by Charlie Parker. There are many others written by devotees of Charlie Parker, in which they kind of come off like music lessons. And in other words, they've gathered the musical personality of bop, but they haven't gathered the essence. And so it comes out a little bit contrived. But to a great extent, I like most of Charlie Parker's. I like a lot of Dizzy's, some of Bud Powell's. But there are other people that wrote things during that time, and some of them leave a lot to be desired.
Barney Kessel, when you started playing professionally in the 40s, there was some really different opportunities for a young musician than there are now.
Yes.
There were, for instance, radio orchestras, radio bands, for which you played for a number of those.
Yes.
It's a non-existent concept.
Yes, it
right
is.
Now.
Uh-huh.
What were those positions like? What were those radio jobs like?
It was before television, and so there would be a radio show, and usually it was done twice. From Los Angeles, you would do one broadcast, a complete show for California and the West Coast, you do another one for New York, the East Coast, because there was a three-hour difference. And in those days, the idea of doing it this way is to have that show come through the radio at a good prime time for both areas, so that if you wanted a show to hit 8 o'clock in the evening, it can't hit 8 o'clock in the evening both in Los Angeles and in New York. So they would do it that way. And the bands were big bands. They were very excellent musicians. Usually they were musicians that had come off of road bands, that had played with the big name bands, and decided, the musician decided to stay in one place and build a home or establish a residency. And there were many, many shows. Some were all musical shows, like the Railroad Hour. Some were comedy shows in which the music were only like little funny cues. You know?
Some of those funny cues, like yada-da-da-da-da.
Yeah. Well, and they have, there were a million bridges, what they call bridges, you know, where the guy, it's almost like a fade out on one scene, says, well, I'll see you tomorrow, says, okay, and they go, and they go, come in, you know, and it's like it's a new scene. So there were shows that had those kind of things that were bridges, these little things.
There's a lot of Hollywood movies about, like Young Man with a Horn, for instance,
yes,
which is kind of like loosely based on Big Spiderback.
Yes.
And Kirk Douglas, who plays, yes, the lead, is always playing in some pop-type band,
yes,
the equivalent of Paul Whiteman, and just really chafing at the bit to really...
do his thing.
To do his thing,
yeah,
to improvise, to play with the band. And of course,
yeah,
the hit members of the band would always sneak out late at night and,
sure,
and improvise together.
Yes.
Did stuff like that really happen in the radio band?
Yes,
where
it happened.
Confined to playing,
yes,
bridge?
It happened. But Young Man was a horn with a Horn really doesn't really depict the way that it is. For instance, I recall in that picture, I think Kirk Douglas made a mistake, and so they called off a record date. Well, you don't call off a record date because someone has a mistake. You've got thousands of dollars invested. If you make a mistake, you say, take two, let's try it again, or take 50. You simply don't just stop. So what he did there was taking a great license with the reality, the way that it is, and so many of the things that depict musicians are totally unreal. I recall for years, anytime it showed in the 30s and the 40s, anytime it showed a band in a motion picture, and they weren't playing, but they had to be up there doing some kind of business, invariably the leader of the orchestra had one stock line that he would always say, and it didn't matter who wrote the picture or who wrote the screenplay, it was always the same line. The band gets through playing, and they show the musicians there, and the leader looks at the band and says, okay, guys, take five.
Right.
They were going through life taking five.
No one really said it, huh?
No, I mean, and not nearly that much.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the way you develop a solo. What from a tune are you going to be thinking about, I know it must vary, mm-hmm, when you're building a solo, like to what effect do you take into account the chord changes or the melody? Is one more important than another to you when you're soloing?
Well, I think the most important parts of a song would be, first of all, I think the words, if there are words. The words are the most important part because words in the language that we speak have a deeper meaning than anything else. Music, color, the scent of something all contribute to a lesser degree in telling a story or telling us about something, but I think that the words are the most important. Secondly would be the melody. Now, if there are no words, then the most important thing would be the melody. There certainly are many memorable melodies that have lasted for hundreds of years that people recall and are affected by. And you take a thing like, a very simple thing like Liebstrom. You take Claire de Lune. You take very, very simple things. Our own songs like America, My Country, 'Tis of Thee. These things may be very simple, but they're singable. They're rememberable. They are something that have great meaning for us. So I do take into account the melody. I also take into account the harmony, but I don't intellectualize the harmony. In other words, by this time in my own development, when I hear harmony, I sense what it is, as though someone were a tailor and they simply feel a material. They know whether it's silk, they know whether it's wool, they know what the garment is. And when I hear a chord, I'm more involved in what kind of texture is it? Then it's B-flat minor 7, and then I can look into the books that I bought from the Music University and Downbeat Magazine, and I can find out what scales I can play against it. I'm not into that. Here I am hearing this B-flat minor 7. What is my reaction to it? What do I want to play against this? And what I want to play at that moment might not be what I would play 5 minutes or 5 years from then. And so it becomes more spontaneous, more natural, and more from within yourself. Rather than saying, well, before I play anything and before I even sense what this is, what is the name of this chord and what are the notes in it and what alternative scales can I use against it? This is intellectualizing something that should be emotional.
But does this emotional ability come only after you can play B minor 7th in your sleep? I mean, does it come only after you have played that scale and the notes within that chord so many times that you don't have to be reminded what's in it? You don't have to think about what it is.
Yes and no. Yes and no. You might sense this and play it emotionally and play it correctly without knowing intellectually what it is, because you have the talent to hear certain passages. On the other hand, the fact that you have played it intellectually for so long and have it under your fingers is no guarantee that you will within yourself ever make a transfer to the emotional side of yourself. Some people play for many years and keep getting more and more technical and more complicated without still reaching that part of them that is their real deepest self.
You've done, I believe, a lot of teaching, and I know you've written columns on the guitar.
Yes.
What's your approach to teaching people how to improvise?
First of all, I don't think that really any teacher can teach. I think that really what a teacher is in any field, I think a teacher is a way shower. I think a teacher can see that you're coming to a fork in the road and they can say to you, I believe I would take the right road and not the left, because if you take the left, it's full of holes and it's muddy and you're going to get your tires caught in some mud there. But you can't make them do it, and you can only point it out. Secondly, I think that a teacher cannot tell you anything, but I think that you can extract a lot from a teacher by pulling on a teacher's coat and saying, I want to learn this, I want to learn this. You can extract it from him or her, but a teacher cannot teach you, but you can get it from the teacher by grabbing for it. And as far as improvising, I certainly don't in any way discredit intellectual grasping of music, to learn scales, to learn note, to learn the theory of it. I think it's very important and necessary. But as soon as possible, people have to realize that at its finest, at its richest, music is an emotional experience. And just because you do pursue it intellectually is no guarantee that you will get it emotionally. And this comes from being able to feel. It comes from being able to view something and cry. It comes from being able to speak to someone and tell them that you're sorry. It comes from a development of a person being able to express his own nature, that the emotions can come in. Otherwise, people have such a heavy facade that they are unreachable. They're in a fortress, going through life, living in a fortress. And that kind of person, when they play, will exhibit intellectual acquirements, but there will be no emotion.
Bernie Kessel, I know that you have recorded sessions which included saxophonist Teddy Edwards.
Uh-huh.
And he said something which I'd like to kind of ask you about. He said that, you know, he's played in some television studio bands. And he said, believe me, when Carson's sitting up there with all these people on the couch, there's more talent in the band that night than there is on that couch usually. How do you feel about playing in television bands and kinds of music that gets played?
Thoroughly underwhelmed by it. It's a gig. It's a job. It's not too much fun. I sure did it a lot, and it buys groceries. But even the people there usually are very tired, and they're not really playing up to what they can do. I mean, it's a service. It's providing a particular musical mood or musical bridge that they need there. But again, it doesn't really involve a lot of self-expression. I don't enjoy it too much. And I find that I don't enjoy musical things or artistic things wherein the product has been conceived, produced, and distributed mainly with money being the number one thing. I certainly don't mind it being number two, and it's number two in my life. But I think here's my feeling on it, Terry. Anything that is made with money as the first consideration can never become art. But something that starts as art may possibly be sold for money.
Mm-hmm. The music that gets played in television settings, as you put it, is usually just like little bridges, not unlike what we're used to hearing on the radio. But I've heard, and I don't know if this is true, you've done enough traveling, you probably know this, I've heard in Europe and in some European countries and in Israel, I've heard, the music that gets played on the quiz shows, like behind the announcer saying, okay, you've got 10 seconds, is jazz that you can hear Coltrane records used on commercials. Have you found this to be true?
Yes. Yes.
Maybe you can explain why that is happening in other countries and why stuff like that never gets on TV here.
Most of the programs I hear that are that way are government-subsidized programs, and they usually don't have commercials. And so they have a greater choice of records that they're playing. It's different, though, when you have sponsors, and those sponsors want to create a certain image. And they don't want a jazz image, or it's not so much even sometimes that they don't want a jazz image, but they may want a certain image. Maybe they're selling something, and what they're selling, they want to appeal to young newlyweds buying this thing. And so the music will be disco, or it will be something of a current thing, which is trying to align with their product. It all has to do with the image that you're trying to create.
You've done arranging for television commercials, right?
Yes.
I always wonder what it's like for someone like you to do that. Because are you going to do your best? Are you going to do what musically excites you most for a television commercial, which isn't really your art, and it's not? No one's really going to know that it's you who arranged it. If I see the commercial, I'm not going to know that unless you tell me. On the other hand, it is your work, and you probably want to do the best, but But it's a job that has to be done.
Yes.
It's not art. Yes. It's a commercial.
Yes.
What of yourself will you put into that?
Only my experience, not maybe a certain amount of talent, but not my self-expression, because that's not what's wanted. They don't really want Barney Kessel, and they don't want a particular jazz thing, or they don't really want my best. They don't want so much what is my best as they want what is appropriate. And for it to fit, it's got to fit the situation. And so you're doing a cat food commercial, and you got a cat eating some food out of a bowl, and it's got to be something that goes along with that picture. And not only should it not, the music should not duplicate what is being shown pictorially, it should actually reach out and grab another dimension that cannot be said with the picture, but which allows you through the picture and the music to get a greater comprehension of what they're trying to say. The music shouldn't duplicate, and it shouldn't even serve as a reinforcement. It should serve as telling another part of this story that cannot be said pictorially or with words. So you use the music.
Can you tell us which are some of the commercials that you've arranged for?
I did a whole series of Rice Krispie commercials years ago when there was a group called the Monkees.
Oh, sure, right.
Well, when they were on television, there were some commercials that would come on during their show. And they had nothing to do with it, but it was their show. And I did those commercials, among others. There's Friskies, cat food, dog food. There's something that was done with in which a lady was singing the words to Tangerine. Figurine, I think, is a commercial.
Yes, that's right.
And singing the words of Tangerine, and Nestle's chocolate. I did Perry Mason show, on television.
Did you write the theme for that?
Not the theme, but did some of the music for it. Yeah, and the answer though is in the commercial field, you stay fairly nameless unless you get a credit, of course. But the thing is to do the job.
Now, another aspect of the work that you've done, and I just found out about this when you came here today, is being a guitarist with some rock and roll sessions. You've worked with who? Elvis Presley, the Beach Boys?
Four pictures with Elvis Presley. I recorded a song Several, but mainly the one that comes to mind with the Beach Boys, I recorded a song called Good Vibrations.
Oh, great.
Yeah, and I recorded a song with the Righteous Brothers called You've Lost That Lovin' Feeling.
Oh, no kidding. You're on that?
And I've recorded with Tina Turner.
Which one?
I can't think of Mountain High or something like that. Or
Mountain High, River Low, is that there?
Yeah, I think so.
You know, I really wish on records like that they gave personnel, because there's just, I mean, I'd love to have known you were on that, and there's no way of knowing unless you're really a kind of a...
I did the first 10 records with Sonny and Cher.
No kidding.
Yeah, Jan and Dean, Gary Lewis and the Playboys, you know, just on and on. But I never was really a rock musician. What they would do, Terry, in those days is they would get the nucleus of a studio band, and they would sweeten it with a few people that really did whatever it was. Like if it was a country western record, they would get a studio band, and then it would add a real country banjo player and a real country fiddle player to this band, and it worked out better. Because if they only used studio band, it didn't sound authentic. If they used only country musicians or only rock musicians, because of their lack of experience in studios, it would take a long, long time to get it done. And then if they made changes, that would be a big, big, major catastrophe. But the flexibility of the studio musicians to go any way was good. So the best way that these productions worked out was to have for the most part, a middle-aged studio band and a bunch of younger guys who played the particular flavor they're trying to do.
What's your relationship to the records you've been on? Do you have a copy of everything that you've recorded?
Or no, I don't.
You just kind of like lose touch with that session after you leave the studio?
Yes, because in most of them, I worked as a sideman. You know, I did records for 25 years, and about 18 of those years, I would do 3 sessions a day.
Mm.
And they weren't my records. I mean, many of them did not reflect my musical taste. I might be playing with a very wide range of artists, and they wouldn't be records I would even care to have. And I don't even have all of the records that I made for myself. I've made maybe 35 albums under my own name. I don't have them all.
Of the many albums that you have recorded, which are some of your favorites?
Soaring on Concord, I would regard as my best album. I usually have never thought about which is the best album, because they have been very close. One has been similar to another as far as the output. But I do think this just came out the best of any album, and really comes closest to depicting how I play in person at this time. Although I've been told by many people that when I am heard in person, that it is different than on record and far better.
Mm-hmm.
So I would think that would be the best one. I would say that the ones that are my favorites would be another album on Concord called Barney Plays Kessel, in which I have 9 originals. Also, another album with Herb Ellis, the two of us together, simply called Barney Kessel and Herb Ellis. And then just several albums that I made for contemporary records with various combinations, various instrumentation, with horns, with woodwinds, with brass. And 5 albums under the contemporary label, specifically called the Pole Winners, with Shelly Mann and Ray Brown.
Mm-hmm.
We did 4 of those during the 60s, and then there was a 15-year break, and we did a 5th one. And I enjoyed those very much. I enjoyed many records that I did for Norman Granz with Verve, when he had that label. I enjoyed them at the time that we did the ones with Billie Holiday, some that I've done with Ella Fitzgerald, some that I have done with Lester Young, many things I did as part of the Oscar Peterson Trio. These would be among my favorites. I did a beautiful record with Julie London called Cry Me a River, and an album called Julie Is Her Name. And I would just say offhand, without thinking further, these would be some of the best records that I made.
Who, to you, are some of the most important jazz guitarists in the history of jazz?
Well, I'll tell you what, I can comment up to the present time. I have made it a habit not to really talk about guitarists in present time, neither good nor bad. Not as an avoidance mechanism, but because so often I'm misquoted And I don't think it's ethical, really, to discuss
that.
Others.
Yeah.
But as far as those who are not living today, mm-hmm. I can certainly discuss them. And I think that as far back as I can remember, from the beginning that my ears ever picked up, as far as jazz, I think people like a guy named Lonnie Johnson and Eddie Lang were the first that were doing something and really making it special and moving towards having a jazz voice. It certainly didn't have great refinement at that time or real center to it, a real direction. It was mostly just playing the guitar, but seeking to break away from only an accompaniment role and improvise and take some courses. And I think that after that, there were people that came up like Al Casey, a guitarist who played with Fats Waller years ago, and Eddie Durham, who played one of the very first to play the electric guitar. And
what about Freddie Green?
Freddie Green played rhythm, only rhythm. And it's a very curious thing. He occupies a very curious position because he's very prominent in the Count Basie band, and what he does is very important. What he does and the prominence that it achieves would never be that discernible if the pianist didn't play like Count Basie, because Count Basie leaves a lot of holes. He leaves a lot of wide-open spaces. This is filled by the guitar. Now, if you had a pianist playing that was just all over the keyboard, this thing that Freddie Green can do would not be that apparent. It would not be that appropriate. So it's a beautiful thing that what he does, he can do his thing because it works in with Count Basie doing his thing. And I think that those guitars that I mentioned finally culminated into someone that came along after that and synthesized it all and put it together, which is Charlie Christian. And I think he became really the first definitive jazz voice that could take a guitar solo and play, not just and where you'd say he's good for a guitar player, but where you said his lines, his solo, were just as good as any of the horn players. That had not really come about until then. There are many unsung heroes along the way, people that wouldn't be heard of or known, people like Teddy Bunn, Django Reinhardt, mm-hmm. Wes Montgomery.
Has it ever happened to you that you've heard a young guitarist and had the strong sense that they've been listening to your records?
Not only had the strong sense, but I can even tell you which records they listened
right.
to. Oh, yeah. Oh, sure.
How do you react to that?
I'm not too thrilled. No, I'm not flattered. No, mm-hmm. no. It's not a compliment. It's not a compliment because, you see, when they play this way, they don't wear a sign saying, I'm playing like so-and-so. I mean, someone comes up and says, that's marvelous, and they say, thank you.
Right.
They say, thank you very much. But I think you can take about as much credit for that as you can some woman is trying to look like Jackie Onassis or Elizabeth Taylor or Farrah Fawcett. I mean, so you look like somebody else. Well, what does that do for you, and where are you? Where are you? Where's your center? What are you saying? You know, you just can't go through life that way. Then the cop-out that I hear many times is, well, you have to learn somewhere. Well, then learn and put a sign on that you're a student. Don't when you're out there for keeps as a professional, you're grown, you're mature, and you're supposed to be out there like everybody else saying your thing. And if you are a student and you're gathering data, then don't come on as though you have a very important message, because that message has already been stated.
You have been doing a lot of touring, 3 continents a year, I think is what you told me.
Yes, the last 7 years.
Doing some touring here on the East. Do you enjoy that? Do you enjoy being on the road that much?
Yes, I do very much. I don't enjoy one-nighters. I don't enjoy missing planes. I don't enjoy finishing playing at 2 o'clock in the morning and have to be on a plane at 8. But that doesn't happen very often. And this may be just a way of philosophically living with it, but I realize and reason that every profession has its good and negative points. A doctor has to get up and go take care of a pregnant woman in the rain. The mailman has to come out when it's snowing. And so every profession has its negative aspects. But I am so grateful to be alive, in good health, playing the music that I want, having enough people that enjoy it that I am able to make a good living, and I do exactly what I want to do. And I think in this world, at this time, it's almost impossible. So I feel very rich and grateful.
Well, it's been great to share in your enthusiasm and in your music and in your stories. Barney Kessel, I want to thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, and thank you for a most sensitive and perceptive interview.
Well, thank you. Barney Kessel is in the Delaware Valley. He will be playing at a club called The Flight Deck tonight and tomorrow night.